She had to come in and train her legs here. I'll bring her. Yeah. Okay, folks, can you hear me? So as always, when the quizzes are done, I will send you the email saying you can come pick them up with the solutions attached and you can check the grading. Hey, is somebody still working on the quiz? Oh, well, it's well past done. Okay, so what I want to do, I mean, we have only three sessions left, right? So today's session and Monday's session. Folks, can I have your attention, please? My undergraduate class said something like, this is for silence. I have no idea. This might be an obscene gesture for all I know. You know? So that might be a trick they're pulling on me. But so we have three sessions left. Today, we're going to continue the discussion of dividends, and I'm going to give you an estimate of how to estimate potential dividend, free cash flow equity. Wednesday, we will come, or next Monday when we come in, I'm going to finish the dividend discussion and get started on valuation. Because all of this class, we've talked about maximizing value, but we've never really confronted the question of how exactly do all of these corporate finance decisions tie into value. And finally, on Wednesday, we'll wrap up valuation so you can go into the weekend ready to finish your project, which is due on Monday. Monday's class will just be your project findings used as a vehicle to review the entire class. So I will take what you found. And the only way I can get that is if you enter the numbers into the Google shared spreadsheet. And that's why I had to create this. I know it's 5 points. You're saying that sounds like nitpicking, but I need the numbers for the Monday class. So as you get done with the numbers for your project, which probably will not happen till very close. So it's Sunday before the class. So I think my deadline is I need to get it by at least 6 p.m. on Sunday, preferably earlier because it'll make my life a little easier. So that I can put it into the packet of money. So let's talk about dividends. We talked about bad reasons for paying dividends. One is that, you know, dividends are certain, so people will reward me for paying more in dividends. Turns out not to be true. The other, of course, is I had a good year. We have lots of cash. Let's give it out as dividends. The problem is once you start that, then you get trapped into dividends. Today, I want to talk about a few good reasons. And one I started on, which is if you have investors who like dividends, paying more in dividends, no matter what the tax guys tell you about how terrible it is, can help you. So I'm going to give you one of the most, academic research you read and say, what's the point of that? This was actually a paper that was fascinating. Look at a company called Citizens Utility. It's still around. It's upstate New York somewhere. And it had shares of stock outstanding, but it had two classes of shares. On one class of shares, they paid a cash dividend. Remember, utilities pay big dividends. On the other class of shares, they paid an exactly equivalent stock dividend. Now, normally, when you get stock dividend, it's kind of useless, right? It's like a stock split. Everybody gets more shares. But in this case, class B shares, you got a stock dividend instead of a cash dividend. And you could convert back into class A shares anytime you wanted. So in effect, here you see what the choice I've given you is. If you want the cash dividend, you can buy the Class A shares. Or if you prefer capital gains, you can buy the Class B shares. And whenever you want, you can convert to cash. Now, if you believed the tax argument, the cash dividend share should be valued much less than the stock dividend shares, right? Because you're getting price appreciation of dividends, investors should value it more. And that's what the study researchers expected to find is a premium on the stock dividend shares because of the price appreciation. What they found was the exact opposite. I know this graph is kind of tough to read, but essentially it's a Class A shares divided by the Class B shares, and you'd expect the Class A shares to trade below the Class B shares, but they consistently traded above. At least in this company, it looks like investors were paying a premium to receive cash dividends. But it was not just not outlier. In fact, about 20 years later, somebody looked at 9 Canadian utilities that have pretty much the same kind of classification, Class A shares, cash dividend shares, or capital gain shares. And in every one of those companies, the cash dividend shares created a premium. So how do you explain this when the tax graph showed that dividends were taxed? And this was in a period where dividends were taxed much more heavily than capital gains. The answer is very simple. The people buying shares in these companies were not typical investors. They were investors who not just like cash dividends, but perhaps didn't care about taxes. That's the clientele effect, is if you pay cash dividends, you will attract people who like the cash dividends. Doesn't mean you will trade at a premium, like as you saw in this case, but you're not necessarily going to be punished for doing it. So digging a little deeper into the clientele effect, studies since have tried to look at what kinds of investors own dividend paying stocks. And the larger the dividend, does your dividend clientele change? And it's not surprising. Older investors and poorer investors are more likely to be shareholders in large dividend paying companies. Not really poor, because then you have no savings at all, but poorer in the sense of on the relative scale. Wealthier investors tend to be investors in high growth companies that often pay no dividends. So you attract a clientele that likes what you do. Okay? In fact, one study actually looked at dividend yields at companies and tried to explain it across companies. And it found, and none of these findings are going to be surprising to you, that riskier companies pay lower dividends than safer companies. Make sense to you? Yeah, makes sense to, you know, so if you, they found that companies with older investors pay higher dividends than firms with younger investors. Firms with wealthier investors pay lower dividends than firms with poorer investors. And they did check out what the effect was of the tax rates themselves. And the bigger the difference between the ordinary income or the dividend income tax rate and the capital gains tax rate, the less dividends got paid across the board. So it's not that tax rates don't matter, but there are some companies that even if they pay dividends, even if the taxes work against dividends, will find an investor base that likes what they do. Let's say one of those companies. Over decades, you've built up an investor base of shareholders who love dividends. You pay them big dividends, they're happy, you're happy. But you reach a point where things are changing in your business. Now, rather than be abstract, think of the phone companies of the 20th century. Yeah.
Why would a higher paid up expect lower dividends? Wouldn't that be awesome? Higher paid in stocks pay lower dividends? Wouldn't you want your higher paid to pay you a higher dividend?
Why do you have higher paid? You're a riskier company. Companies which are riskier can't pay dividends, right? You want higher expected returns. Don't buy high beta stocks because you expect high dividends. You're going to be deeply disappointed, right? It's a high beta stock. It's high risk. You want a higher expected return, but in what form will the returns show up if it's a high beta stock? What's the other component of expected return to shareholders? Price appreciation. You buy risky companies, almost all of your return is going to come in the form of price appreciation. They can't afford to pay dividends. And you shouldn't be expecting dividends. You expect a higher return, but it's almost all going to come from price appreciation. So let's say you're a phone company. You spent a century building up this reputation of a big dividend paying company. And you could do that, right? Because you're a mature company, you weren't growing very fast, you're a monopoly for much of this period, you have predictable earnings, and you pay dividends. All of a sudden, let's assume that your business has changed. It's gone from being a monopoly to competitive, from being predictable to unpredictable. And you know you will have to invest a great deal into the business to keep it going. So you have a problem. Your dividend policy is in conflict with what you need as a company. So you're the CEO of the company. I'm going to give you a list of choices. And with each one, I'm going to stop and ask you to play out what will happen if you make that choice. The first is, you can get in front of your shareholders at the annual meeting. And remember who your shareholders are, no? Right? When you get up in front of them and tell them that you're going to cut dividends and you explain to them why. We're a risky company now. We have lots of growth opportunities. We can't afford what we've done for the last century. What'll happen if you do that? We kind of talked about this, I think, 2 sessions ago. You're doing the right thing, right? You're saying, I have to change dividends, Dor.
So Supposedly you would get fired, but it depends on your board.
But who's on your share? But think about your shareholders. Shareholders, remember your shareholders and your board have been nurtured in a very different company. Not just the shareholders in shop. The board members are not happy either, right? They're probably older board members who are used to paying dividends and sending that notice out for the 88th year in a row, we increased dividends by. We've seen those missives come out from companies. You got to get them to go along. Nobody's happy. So if you say, look, I'm going to cut dividends, the initial reaction is going to be no way. So let's try the second one. Maybe you can continue to pay dividends. This is the strategy where you don't confront your problem. You continue to pay dividends through one hand and issue shares in the other. What's the advantage of doing this? Well, you keep your shareholders happy and you hope they don't notice that there's a dilution effect going on. You're issuing new shares because your bankers are also happy. The downside is it is costly, right? Because you have to issue new shares. My guess is most companies take the second option. In fact, this is exactly what happened at the phone companies when they started to become technology companies. Is it? The third is you continue to pay the dividends and turn, I'm sorry, so that we did see, you continue to pay dividends and don't grow in your business, in which case you end up becoming a shrinking company because you're not reinvesting, you don't have the technology. And a few of the phone companies, if you remember, AT&T was broken up into what, 8 different Bell companies, not all behave the same way. And if you want to take a look at history, take a look at how those different Bell companies evolved in the face of technology. I mean, companies like Verizon ended up at the top of the heap. But there were other Bell companies that ended up as sad little messes because they did not reinvest. But there's a fourth option. It's an option where you get to eat your cake and keep it too. You know what AT&T itself did in the 1990s to allow for the fact that a portion of its business was high growth? They created a spin-off called Lucent. Lucent, we called it Lucent Technologies. In fact, the name itself was to separate it from AT&T. Lucent was the old Bell Labs. Remember, Bell Labs was, for a century, the place where people went to do basic research. It had Nobel Prize winners. And AT&T was able to fund it because it had money coming in from the phone business. So Bell Labs got renamed Lucent, called a technology company, and spun off. And AT&T shareholders, remember those old shareholders who like dividends, were given a choice. You can either stay shareholders in AT&T and collect a dividend, or you can get shares in this new company called Lucent, which is a technology company that we've spun off. But here's the downside. You're not going to get dividends there. And you have to accept it's a riskier, high-growth company. They allowed shareholders to self-select. You don't need that many shareholders to self-select. If 20% of the shareholders move away and say, okay, I'll take the spin-off, you've essentially accomplished your objective. You now have a base company, which is the old phone company that continues to pay dividends, and a new spin-off that actually does what the right thing is, which is not pay dividends, reinvest a great deal. So when businesses change, watch out for this, because often you will see companies start to spin off segments, sometimes for operating reasons, but sometimes just to reflect the fact that the shareholders in the old company are not going to be happy with what you need to do in that spin-off. Yes, sir.
What's the downside?
The downside, there's really no downside from doing this. The process of spinning off itself is a little expensive. And you have to. Well, I think in a sense, that's often why they don't want to deal with it. They prefer, and also it's control. Because remember, once you spin it off, that part of the business is outside your control as AT&T CEO. That's a big deal. If you want to keep control of, remember, those are the most exciting businesses in it. And I'm asking you to take your most exciting businesses, spin them off, put a different CEO. And you're saying, but I want to be that CEO. No, you want to go back to being the CEO of the old boring business. And very few CEOs want to do it. So there's that conflict of interest of the right thing to do for the company. And what do I want to do as CEO to keep my life exciting? My guess is this is going to be coming to businesses like the pharmaceutical business. Everywhere where there's disruption, you're going to see more spin-offs happen, because if you have a company with different parts requiring very different dividend and financing policies, it's tough to keep them all as a consolidated company and try to fund them all as one company. Let's look at the second reason given for why dividends are a signal. Starting in the 1970s, there was a whole area of research in finance that presented the view that the reason companies initiate and increase dividends is to send a signal to markets. Let me explain the basis for the story. Remember what we said about how companies have to feel sure about their earnings, secure about their earnings to pay dividends? So let's say you're in a sector of 25 companies. It's a pretty volatile sector. 24 of the 25 companies have unpredictable earnings. But for whatever reason, you have 50% of your revenues come from government contracts. You feel secure about your earnings. And you want to set yourself apart from the other 25. So when you pay a dividend or increase a dividend, you're sending a signal to the market saying, look at me, I feel so confident about my future earnings. I'm able to do this. Those 24 cannot do it. Reward me with a higher stock price. At least overall, if you look at what happens in the market when companies increase or cut dividends, it seems consistent with the signaling story. It's a graph which looks at what happens to stock prices on the announcement. Remember, we said the news about dividends happens on the announcement day, on the announcement of a dividend cut and an announcement of a dividend increase. Let's start with the aggregate information. When dividends are increased, the stock price jumps about 1%. So don't get too excited. This is not a booming 50% increase. On average, when dividends are increased, the stock price goes up 1%. On average, when dividends are decreased, the stock price goes down about 5%. Let's start by explaining that asymmetry. A dividend increase is good news, but a dividend decrease is really, really bad news. How do you explain that? Remember the graph I showed you, the number of companies that increase dividends versus decrease dividends? But 4 to 5 times as many companies increase dividends as decrease dividends. So already that number suggests that when a company cuts dividends, it must be because something catastrophic is happening. It might not be true, but who can blame investors for making that judgment? Dividend increases on average look like good news, and dividend decreases on average look like bad news. That's a dividend signaling story. But here's the problem with the signaling story. I can tell you a different story about dividends where an increase in dividends is actually a bad signal. Somebody wanted to fill in a story where a company increases dividends and he said, oh my God, that's terrible. I'm going to sell the stock.
Maybe you could imagine that the company or the managers think that it's not growing.
Which is not a problem if you invest in a mature company, but if you invest in a growth company, which you thought had great growth potential, and they come out and say, you know what, we're doubling dividends, your first reaction is something must have changed in the company. They're not having the investment opportunities that they had. A dividend increase can act as a negative signal at growth companies because investors look and say, oh my God, my good days of growth are done. And there is some evidence that companies announce dividend increases when growth has. So when you look at when companies initiate dividends, companies often initiate dividends when their growth days have peaked. So the way to read this graph is these are the years before and after initiating dividends on earnings growth. So there's the earnings growth leading into the dividend increase. It peaks actually in the year. And then afterwards, if you look at what growth looks like, it starts. So investors have good basis for saying, you know what? My growth must have peaked. My company initiated dividends this year. So dividends can operate as a positive signal in some companies, negative signal in others. But there's an overall, you know, body of evidence accumulating on dividends. It suggests that there's a bigger force at play. This actually looks, remember I showed you the graph on dividend increases versus decreases, how they affect stock prices. This is from a 1962-74 study. Dividend increases up 1%. So that's a study that you saw. There was a follow-up study, 75 through 87. Same general conclusions, but the increases are smaller and the decreases are smaller. You get to 1988 through 2000, they become even smaller. Overall, dividend changes have seemed to have a smaller signaling impact now than they did 30 years ago, 50 years ago, 70 years ago. Why is that? What do you think is happening in the market? Yes.
Trading has become more computerized, so there's less emotional.
Trading is the most emotional of all things. Computers just play on emotion. You could argue that trading actually increases the emotional momentum because it builds up forces and tries to build up.
But if you're feeding dividend increase or cut will necessarily decrease your valuation. Whereas if you are a dividend investor and you see the dividend
there's an argument here, but in my view, algorithms are often just pure trading instruments. They don't even try to estimate intrinsic value. They just get ahead of next day's move and the next week's move. So trading by itself, and remember, much of that is in the last 20 years, right? So it can't explain what's happened in this graph, but maybe if I look at 2010 through 20, you can say it's computer algorithm, it's computerized trading.
If
everybody knows that your growth is increasing or you have reliable cash flows, there's enough information coming out from analysts, from other investors on your future earnings. Dividend signaling is a very, very, you know, it's a blunt instrument, right? To increase or decrease dividend, just tell the market, look at me, I'm good. To the extent that external information now is both more accessible and much greater magnitude, you could argue that the information effect of dividend changes has become smaller and smaller. And I think that's a good thing. I've never been comfortable with the notion of companies having to increase dividends just to tell the market, look at me, my earnings are more secure. Because I think that's a very dangerous trap you put companies into. And if you look across time, you can see the information effect of dividends seems to be decreasing. Now, I don't want to make too big a prediction, but 20 years from now, if you looked at this graph and you looked at 2001 through 2030, my guess is you're going to see even smaller changes. At some point, dividend changes by themselves will not completely lose their signaling impact, but almost go away.
So dividends have a clientele that you could have a clientele that likes dividends. You might be using dividends to signal to markets, but you should do so only if you're a small company. Nobody's following you. Nobody's noticing. If you're Apple and you're increasing dividends to signal to markets, doesn't make any sense to me. Large market cap companies, widely followed companies. So I would expect dividends to continue to have their power in smaller, more emerging markets where you don't have the information and to begin to lose their informative power in markets where you have that information. So dividends, you have your clientele might like dividends. Second, dividends of information. Third and final reason for paying dividends. And I'm going to call it a good reason, even though it's not motivated by the best of interests. Remember, there are two players in this game. You have lenders, you have equity investors, right? So when you lend money to a firm, you base it on expectations of what the company will do, what it'll invest in, what financing it'll take, and how much it'll pay in dividends. Sometimes you write in covenants on what the company cannot do. But let's say you're lending to a company which is large, and you say, well, I don't worry. It's like the Nabisco effect. There's no, I won't write in covenants. They've usually paid 30% of their earnings as dividends. I'm going to assume they will continue to do that. You're saying, why as a lender do I care what they pay in dividends? Because whatever's not paid in dividends stays in the firm as cash, as retained earnings. It makes your lending safer. So you set an interest rate based on that. I know you've set the interest rate based on that. The existing management get replaced by a new, more aggressive management. They look at the lending agreements, so you have a lot of long-term debt already locked in at a nice low rate, and you double the payout ratio. Legally, you're allowed to do that, right? Overnight, you've made the loans riskier. Just like the KKR LBO of Nabisco made bonds riskier, big dividend payments or increasing dividend payments make debt riskier. You know how this plays out? Remember that graph I showed you about what happens to stock prices around dividend increases? There's a stock price increase. That's what happens to bonds in these companies around big dividend increases. If you track companies right after they increase dividends and you look at their bond prices, you'll see a drift down. And it makes sense. Bond owners are saying this company is now a riskier company than it was before it increased dividends. So those are the three reasons companies have for paying dividends. But you can see whatever the reasons are, those reasons must be getting less powerful because in the aggregate, US companies are paying less in dividends and shifting away from dividends into buybacks.
Is there graph or buybacks?
Buybacks have the same effect on debt. When you have big buybacks, you have a debt effect. The stock prices tend to go up, but there the stock price of some of that stock price effect comes from the fact that there are fewer shares outstanding. But the bond price drop, you see with every cash return. So it's that's a motivation for any kind of cash return to your equity investors. If you're not constrained, you're going to do these cash returns and make your lenders worse off. Which means as a lender, what should you start doing when you lend even to reputable companies? You have to have covenants, and you might not be able to stop buybacks, but you can tie your interest rate to the buyback. Say, if there is a buyback, we get the power to renegotiate the interest rate. I think that's a fair thing to do. And I don't know why banks don't do it more with when you have buybacks of the magnitude that you often see at companies.
So when we calculate after a buyback, the drop in the cost of capital, there should actually be an increase after that because you're
actually what I do though is remember in my cost of capital calculation, what do I force you to do with the existing debt? I actually increase the interest rate. So the value effect you're computing with my cost of capital spreadsheet actually doesn't assume any ripping off of the bondholders. To the extent that you can keep those bondholders at the old interest rate while moving, there will be an added value. I did not want to count that as value from going to the new optimal because I don't think that's right to say, I'm going to go to the optimal just because I can rip off my bondholders, just moving wealth around. But to the extent that you can keep the old debt at the old rates, it's one of the options actually in the spreadsheet. Do you want to keep old debt at old rates? I could have restated that question of, do you want to rip off your bondholders, yes or no? And if you said yes, I'll keep the debt at the old rates, you will go to a new debt ratio with a higher cost of debt, but they're stuck with the old cost of debt until the debt comes to you. So, you know, managers are often asked, you know, why do you pay dividends? And if you look at this survey, you can see why managers have absolutely no clue on dividends. You look across in every single statement, you know, agree, disagree, no opinion. What does that tell you? Most of these questions, managers have absolutely no idea what dividends does to their stock price. Does it help them? Does it make them riskier? Why do they keep doing it? Because everybody else does. Dividend policy, as I said, is dysfunctional because managers are so caught up with preserving what they've always done. They don't want to stop and ask, does that make sense for me anymore? So what I'd like to do is start on the process, at least, of thinking about how much can my company pay out in dividends? So how much can my company return to its shareholders? And then we can ask, should it be in dividends or buybacks? So to start this process, I'm going to take you through two approaches. The second approach you should be familiar with, which is to look at the peer group, but then adjust the fact that you might be a larger company, a more stable company, your shareholders might have higher tax rates. We'll talk about a peer group adjusted dividend policy. But I want to go through the first approach because I think it's an approach that every company, in my view, should go through to decide on returning cash to shareholders. So the first approach, here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to start out by looking at what you've actually returned to your shareholders in dividends and buybacks. Let's get a measure of, hey, how many billions did you return last year, 2 years ago, 3 years ago? That should be easy, right? And you're going to find that information in the statement of cash flows, dividends and stock buybacks. So when you look up your company and capital IQ, you can pull up dividends and buybacks for every year as far as the data goes. That's an easy one. Step two, I'm going to estimate how much this company could have paid out or returned to its shareholders each year. It's a surprisingly easy question to answer because that information is also in the statement of cash flows. I'm going to call it a potential dividend or free cash flow to equity, but that's just a fancy word for whatever cash is left over after you've met every conceivable need. So in step one, I look at what you've actually returned. Step two, I look at what you could have returned. If you're a very unusual company, the company might have exactly returned what it can afford to. But most of you are going to end up in one of two circumstances. One is that your company is holding back cash. It's not returning as much as it could. And it'll show up also as a big cash balance of the company. The other is the company is returning more than it should, and in which case it's digging through existing cash balance, sometimes doing really strange things like borrowing money to pay dividends or borrowing money to do buybacks or issuing stock to do so. And with each one, I want you as a shareholder to be able to ask the question, does that make sense? When you have a company that you own shares in and it's accumulating cash, will you automatically jump up and down and say, I want my cash back? Or are you going to be selective in which companies you do that? So let's start with this process by looking at how much cash has actually been returned. And I'm going to use my companies to illustrate this process. So for each of my companies, I went and looked at dividends and buybacks each year. And you can see again, Baidu, there's nothing and nothing. So that made my life easier. And for some of you, that's going to be the case. You look at the last 5 years, no dividends, no buybacks. Company hasn't returned any cash. I have a few people every year who then in their dividend section will say, my company had no dividends and did no buybacks. Therefore, there is nothing to discuss. Is that true? There's still a question you need to answer, right? Which is, does it make sense that they did not return cash? In some companies, it might make sense. Why? Because they have negative cash flow, free cash flow, so equity. They're growing and they're reinvesting too much. They're risky. In some companies, it might make no sense at all. They're maturing companies actually have the capacity to return cash. So just because your company doesn't pay dividends doesn't mean it doesn't have a dividend policy. There's a policy of paying zero dividends. And you have to explain whether that makes sense. So in my case, if you look at the companies, start with Disney, has paid out about $4.5 billion in dividends in the 5 years leading into my calculation. Has returned $15.4 billion in buybacks. It's the aggregation of companies like Disney that gives us that chart, right? Where two-thirds of the cash returned by U.S. companies came in the form of buybacks. You can see that on a company-by-company level. If you look at Vale, $24 billion in dividends, $5.7 billion in buybacks. 20% of the cash comes from buybacks, 80% from dividends. If you look at Tata Motors, at least in 2013, they had no buybacks, all dividends. No, Baidu, what I talked about. Mm-hmm. And Deutsche Bank has paid dividends every year for the last 5 years. And that's actually surprising because leading into 2013, they were losing money. The regulatory capital was in stress, but they were continuing to pay dividends. That's a dysfunction of dividends we talked about. So let's start by looking at how much a company can afford to pay in dividends. I want you to play the role of the owner of a business. It's a private business. You run the business. And here's what you do. You're sitting in front. So it's an old-fashioned business with a cash till, right? Today, it might be just an automated version of the cash till. So you run the business. You get net income. That is your income as the owner of the business. But you know, earnings are not cash flows. You add back the depreciation, amortization, other. So you now have the total cash in the till, right? So that's basically it. From this, you've got to start writing out checks to different groups. Starting with, if there's any CapEx, you got to pay for the CapEx. So that comes out of the till. If there's an increase in working capital, inventory goes up, that comes out of the till. If you have debt payments to make, that comes out of the till. But if you're lucky enough to borrow fresh money, remember that goes into the till. So after all of this process is played through, you look at what's left in the till. That's cash you can take out of the business without hurting the future of the business. Remember, the CapEx has already been paid for. The working capital has been invested in. So you can't tell me this is hurting future growth. I've allowed you to invest in this. Whatever's left over after you've met your reinvestment needs, taxes, and debt payments, we'll call it free cash flow equity. Sounds fancy, but it's potential dividend. If you take a look at what I need to compute this, almost everything I need comes out of the statement of cash flows, right? Let me go item by item. You tell me where on the statement of cash flows I would find it. Trust me, this is not deep accounting. This is very simple accounting. Where would I find net income in the statement of cash flows? It starts right at the very top of the operating cash flow. Net income is right there. You say, can't I use it in the income statement? No, stay with the statement of cash flows. It is the most honest accounting statement out there because it's cash in, cash out. There's no game plan. Right below it will be plus depreciation and amortization. So you got that item right there. In fact, there are other non-cash charges. They'll be right there as well. But let's keep working through the operating cash flow. What else is in that operating cash section? There'll be like 10 different working capital items, right? Inventory, receivables. The sum of all of those is your change in working capital. So in the operating section of the statement of cash flows, you have net income, you have depreciation, you have change in working capital. So what about CapEx? Move to the next section, which is the investing section. There might be investments in bonds and financial assets. ignore them because those are not capex, but investment in land, building, equipment, machinery should show up there. As should show up, what else? Companies in a hurry to grow. And it doesn't want to take its own projects. It does acquisitions. Cash acquisitions will also show up. They're part of capex as well. Don't play any accounting games. It's cash leaving the till, right? You acquire another company. It is cash leaving the till just as it is to build a factory. In the investing section, you'll see everything you need for capex. We're almost there. What else do we need? Debt issued, debt repay. Keep going down. You come to the financing section. And here you got to be careful not to get distracted. In addition to debt issued and debt repaid, what else are you going to see in the financing section? You'll see dividends paid as a cash outflow. Buybacks as a cash outflow. That's what they do it. So don't subtract it out to get to free cash flow and equity. You're trying to explain the dividends and buybacks. So take the portion of the financing section that's debt. You're going to come up with the free cash flow and equity. In fact, there's a simplified version of this where you can consolidate capex, depreciation, change in working capital into reinvestment. And you can consolidate the debt issued and repaid into net cash flow from debt. And if you want to simplify it even further, you can do it as a ratio where you say, this is my net income and this is how much of the net income I have to put back. And that ratio can be higher than 100%. Why? Because you might have huge capital expenditures relative to your depreciation. Huge capex by itself is not the issue. Huge capex and huge depreciation offset each other. Is when your capex is huge relative to depreciation, you can end up with free cash flows to equity, which are negative. Let's pause right there. If your free cash flow to equity is negative, how much can you afford to return to your shareholders? Your life got simple. You should return zero. And if your company is actually returning cash, then you have to explain why it's doing what it's doing. Maybe last year's free cash flow to equity was negative, but the previous years was positive. And this is why you compute free cash flow to equity at least 3, 4, 5 years to get a sense of what can my company return. Now, if you think about forecasting these numbers, and sometimes people value the equity in a company by forecasting free cash flow equity, think of all the items you're forecasting. You're forecasting net income, capex, depreciation, change in working capital. In fact, if you break working capital out, inventory, receivables, you've got a financial model going, right? 10, 15, 20 different line items. While you might be excited about building this detail, remember, you have to forecast each of these line items. Something you remind yourself every time you build a financial model, every additional line item is another line item you have to forecast. So I'm looking always for ways to make this more parsimonious because I'm lazy. I want to forecast 4 rather than 40 line items. So here's a shortcut you can use if you have to forecast future free cash flow equity. So this is not about explaining the past. For the past, always use the full calculation. But let's say you have to forecast the free cash flow equity for a company. In the future, you start with net income. You have no choice but to forecast net income here. Take the capex, depreciation, working, capex and depreciation, net them out. It's called net capex. That measures how much you're growing your fixed asset or long-term asset base. But remember, as an equity investor, what do you care about? What percentage of that comes from me? It's all about you as the equity investor here. If somebody else is paying for it, you say, that's not my problem. So if 80% of that net capex comes from equity investors, you subtract out only the 80%. Same thing with the working capital. It's a drain on your cash flows. That's true. But if you have to come up with only 80%, you subtract out only the 80% that comes from. Which leaves me. And if you look at that equation, there's something very interesting that emerges. And at first sight, it looks like a freebie for equity investors. As I increase my debt ratio, what happens to my free cash flow equity? I'm letting lenders bear more and more of the reinvestment needs, right? I get to keep more of the cash flow. So my free cash flow equity will actually get higher as I borrow more money. This is good, right? But what do I discount free cash flow equity back at to get the value of equity? Cost of equity. What goes into cost of equity? Risk-free rate, equity risk premium, and a beta. So if I decide to use more debt to pump up my free cash flow equity, guess what's also happening to my cost of equity? It should also be increasing. So the net effect will determine whether this is okay for you. But if you get entirely focused on, I want to increase free cash flow equity, go to 100% debt. Let somebody else bear this. Of course, you're going to blow up your company in the process, but at least in the near term, you can say, look at my free cash flow to equity. Warren Buffett has a version of free cash flow to equity where he calls it owner's earnings, where he takes net income, adds depreciation, and subtracts CapEx. The reason he ignores working capital is, at least in the companies that he targets, which tend to be mature companies, working capital tends not to be a big drain on the cash flow, so it kind of ignores it. His version of owner's earnings is a free cash flow to equity measure, and he looks at this. Supposedly, he claims that that's one of the things he looks at to decide whether to invest in a company. Does this company have significant owner's earnings? Which also means that he's going to be investing in a lot of mature companies like Kraft Heinz and not that many companies which have high growth, because you're not going to get high owner's earnings even at great growth companies, because money has to go back into the business. So in my case, here's what I did. I computed the free cash flow equity for Disney every year from 2008 through 2012. And let me look at the aggregate numbers. Over the 5 years, Disney was a pretty good cash flow machine. It generated $18.5 billion in free cash flow equity. So I did what so these all come from Disney's statement of cash flows. So how much money could Disney have returned? $18.5 billion. They actually returned $19.9 billion. They returned about $1.5 billion more. Does that make them irrational? Not quite, because when we did the capital structure for Disney, what did we conclude about Disney? It's under-levered or over-levered? Under-levered. If you're under-levered, one of the ways you move up to your optimal over time is by using the paying out more than you can get in dividends. So that might maybe there's some bad reason for this, but at least on the surface, I'm not willing to conclude that Disney is crazy, because they were under-levered, and it does look like they can use, but they can go on paying a little bit more in free cash flow equity than dividends. No. Just to show you how the shortcut would work, in 1996, Microsoft was at the peak of its Darth Vader status, right? It was basically rising to the top of the operating system, driving Apple out of the business. And one of the great cash flow machines on the face of the earth. So I computed the free cash flow equity, net income minus net capex minus change in working capital. They had no debt at that point in time. And their free cash flow equity was $2,127 million. So let's pause right there. You have $2,127 million free cash flow equity. How much can you afford to pay out? Obviously, $2,127 million. They return nothing. So I have a very simple mechanical question. And I think we've answered this indirectly in earlier sections, but let's get this nailed down. You have $2,127 million in free cash flow equity, and you choose to return none of it. If they chose to return none of it, where would I find that $2,127 million on Microsoft's balance sheet? I'm glad you said the cash balance and not the retained earnings, right? Return earnings is net income minus dividend. This is free cash flow equity minus what's returned. When companies choose not to return cash, it goes in your cash balance. So Microsoft added $2.12 billion to their cash balance in 96. 97, they had $3 billion in free cash flow equity. They returned nothing. So what happens? You add another $3 billion. 1998, they had, I think, a $4.5 billion. Why big jump? Every office upgrade for them adds another billion in free cash. Used to, at least in the old model, used to add $1 billion in free cash flow equity. Return nothing. You can see how this builds up over time, right? And in fact, by the time you get to, I think, the late 90s, Microsoft had the largest cash balance in corporate history. It's since been overtaken by Apple. But it got there because year after year, it kept back cash it could have returned. So that's how you look at a non-financial service company, by looking at the statement of cash flow. You're saying, what about a bank? Can I compute free cash flow equity for a bank? You can, but it's trickier. It goes back to redefining what net capex and change in working capital is. I used to try to compute free cash flow equity for a bank and get stuck every single time. There's no net capex, no change in working capital you can use. And you can look at the statement of cash flows to do this. So what I decided to do, and this was only after 2008, I said, look,
reinvestment for a bank is what they need to put in regulatory capital, which is actually in their financials, but it might not be in the statement of cash flows. Any increase in reinvestment regulatory capital or regulatory capital becomes the equivalent of reinvestment. So in the case of Deutsche, here's what I did. I projected out the net income, and here I'm making some pretty optimistic assumptions about what will happen to return on equity. So the net income goes from a loss to a profit and subtracted out how much they need to reinvest in regulatory capital. So I'm taking into account the fact that Deutsche right now is a money-losing bank with a dangerously low regulatory capital. The way this plays out is my free cash plus equity on big negative numbers for the next 3 years. How much did I remember the graph, the table I gave you for the dividends that Deutsche was paying? You look at these free cash flow equity and your reaction is that makes no sense. They should be issuing equity, not returning cash. So if you have none of you has a financial service company, but if you did analyze a financial service company, this is one way that says, is JP Morgan paying out too much in dividends? Is First Republic? Yeah, obviously. Yeah. But this is a question that you have to ask. Many small and mid-cap banks probably have dividends now that they cannot afford to pay. Because you can see changes coming at these banks, right? What if tomorrow the Fed says, you got to take those bond losses that pull down, Silicon Valley Bank and First Republic and show them as losses, reduce your book equity and bring in fresh equity. These banks are all going to be undercapitalized. So thinking about free cash flow equity might be a good way to separate good mid-cap banks from bad mid-cap banks. Mid-cap banks that are going to survive these changes coming from mid-cap banks that are going to have to be acquired by other banks because they cannot really afford to do so. So next session, when we start off, we will look at dividends and free cash flow equity, for individual companies. But we'll take each company and play it out. Look at the dividends, free cash flow equity. What do we do as shareholders in this company? So see you on Monday. Yeah, they don't give you a free, don't take their free cash flow, but they'll give you the line item. You're second path, right? You help them. There was one other person who decided not to show up at all. So he must have waited too long. So basically, I've taken that walk, so I know exactly how long it takes. So that's okay.
Hi. My company is a software development. They're like a gaming company, right? Okay. They do this Take-Two Interactive. They do like video games.
Yeah.
So in the long-term debt, the portion of it is software development fees, like licensing for like over years, but they don't specify the number of years and it is or whatever.
Did they show it in the balance sheet as debt?
They show it in the balance sheet as debt. Yeah.
They've done it for once, mistaken.
But is that considered interest-bearing long-term debt?
Well, if they show it on the balance sheet as debt, they're including it as interest-bearing.
Okay, because like on Yahoo, like Yahoo Finance, they don't consider it as part of long-term interest-bearing debt.
Why is it long-term? Where's the long-term coming?
Because they're licensing fees that they have to
pay. All we care about is interest-bearing debt, right? So if it is treated as debt on the balance sheet, then it is being treated as interest-bearing debt because the accounting for it requires it, right? So there must be capital out taking the doing what we did with operating leases to those commitments.
Yeah, so I included leases, but so you're saying the licensing fees and royalties is considered long-term interest-bearing
debt. Exactly.
Okay, cool. Thank you.
Yes.
There you go. What's a good time?
How about... you can set up on Monday if you want to come in. If you want to set up a Zoom session on Friday, you can do that too. Would you prefer to do it over Zoom on Friday?
Tomorrow morning, around 10 at lunch.
Tomorrow I'll be on a flight in the morning, so I'll be on a plane.
What to meet in person?
To meet in person. I'll be back on Monday. So I leave tomorrow and I come back on Monday. How about 5? Yeah. At 5 in the afternoon, later in the day.
How about like
12 to 1?
Are you here at 8:50?
12 to 1 Monday. Sure. Let's make it 12 to 1. Yeah, sounds good.
Perfect.
Okay. Take care. Hi. Yeah.
So with the spin off, what do you do with that?
You always will, right? Because the price adjusts. So when you do the there will always be enough shareholders because you can open it up to the outside market as well. So they can sell their, so it's not like they need to hold as long as there's demand outside and you set the price.
It's not a new company. Theoretically, no one fights internally, but then the market takes the
exact has
essentially. But
that's like warrants, right? If you say, look, I don't want a warrant, you get the warrant anyway.
Yeah.
You can sell the warrant to somebody else, which means that essentially you collect the cash from doing so. So what it's doing is allowing existing shareholders to cash out a portion of their shares, the risky company portion. So their share price will drop, but they will get cash in the pocket. So
people start, let's say like no one moves, the market then
steps in. Exactly.
And then that's essentially taking that part of the business out. So the value of the company goes out.
Okay. Yeah.
That makes sense. Is that generally like you mentioned the bottom companies? Do you think it is like a good thing or a bad thing?
I think it's a mixed blessing. If you're a lender to a pharma company, it's definitely not a good thing, right? For Johnson & Johnson to spin off a portion of the business, essentially. I mean, as long as they're spinning off the riskier parts of the business, you're probably happy. If they're spinning off the safest parts of the business to make them cash cows, and you're stuck with the parent company that has all the riskier parts of the business, and it's terrible. So bondholder perspective, it's usually not great news. From a shareholder perspective, it depends on how the spin-off plays off in terms of improving the operations of each of the spin-off businesses.
And how does that work when you have a parent company that owns public company beneath it, like
it doesn't. Once it's spun off, it becomes an independent company. You no longer own it. Remember, that's why you divide the shares up, right? So if you're an AT&T shareholder and you get shares in Lucent, after the spin-off, you have two companies and you'll see two companies in your portfolio, AT&T and Lucent. Lucent has its own board of directors, own annual meeting. AT&T now owns none of Lucent.
Okay. Right? So it's just a carve out, essentially.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. And then for the debt ratio, mm-hmm. you said like, you know, doing like the fixed analysis because the changes in debt ratio can cause them to have big fluctuations. Do we just do that like after we do the capital assessment, say, all right, the target debt ratio
should be this? In fact, it's a good way of thinking. Let's say your company right now pays no dividends and you conclude it makes sense with negative free cash flow equity. You can follow up by saying, okay, that makes sense for now, but what's happening in terms of trends?
So it's more like forward looking, like if their debt ratio should be 20%,
right?
Then you look at it under, do you look at the historical stuff under 20% lines, or are you saying
no, just the future? There's a new projection.
And then lastly for Deutsche, when finding the regulatory requirements,
mm-hmm.
it's something I remember touched on briefly like a while ago when you first brought that sheet. The tier one capital, is that's the regulatory
it's book capital? But if you don't have it, it's basically if you take the book equity in the balance sheet, it's 90% of tier one capital. So every time book equity goes up and down, tier one capital is going up and down.
What exactly is tier one capital?
That's capital that's supposed to be equity capital, residual claims on the cash flow. So anything that qualifies as being a residual claim as being originally was just equity.
I guess I'm confused how they're disconnected.
Because you can include with Credit Suisse, one of the things they did was issued this loan where you didn't get interest payments and you didn't have any entitlement to cash flows. I don't know what the loan actually entitled you to be quite honest. It's like a floating interest payment tied to earnings with no liquidation claim, which makes it more and more like equity because you're just basically getting when they make money, you make interest. If they don't make money, you make nothing. Is it liquidate? You don't get any claim on the assets. That's how banks have kind of threaded the needle of we don't want to issue shares, but we want to increase our regulatory capital. So it's basically game playing on how the regulatory authorities define equity and they create all these new securities and say, that meets very much what you require for an equity. So we're going to classify it as equity. That's why I said for most healthy banks, the book equity is your tier one capital.
And then how do you find regulatory capital?
Yeah.
Is that just from at least with US banks, a disclosure they have to make to the